Hello, and welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. I just want to apologize before I get into today's show, because in the background you might happen to hear my two bunnies, Malcolm and Sally. They've been a little excited today because of all of the nice weather that we've been having. So if you happen to hear any, you know, thuds or thumps or whatever, any odd noises in the background, it's just the two bunnies. They're out, they're having a lot of fun, hopping around, making some noise, and, you know, just playing and stuff. So I do want to apologize for that. So today's show is going to be really cool because I want to talk to you about imagination. Now, you might be thinking, oh, imagination, I know that. That's when you think up things and you have some creativity and like an imaginary friend. And not quite. It's a little different, but that's going to be one of the topics. I have a book update for you. I'm going to be talking about some different historical books that might be of interest to you. And then I also want to talk to you again about our promo contest. So I'm going to go ahead and start off with the promo contest. I released a mini episode recently that talks about this contest. I had kind of come to the conclusion that, you know, I'm not very good when it comes to that sort of stuff. I just get stuck for ideas and I don't really know what to do. You'd think that coming up with a show and coming up with the topics for the show all the time and stuff, that things should just be fine. But I realized that all of you probably have much better ideas than I do. So I created a contest and I am asking all of you to participate. I'm hoping that you will enter the contest, and all you have to do if you enter the contest is to come up with a good idea for the show. It needs to be an idea that I can put into a promo, and the promo should sum up what this show's about, and when recorded, it should be no longer than 30 seconds in length, and it should appeal to gamers like you. Now, you don't have to record the promo. You really don't. I'm just looking for ideas. So you can, you know, create a script. You can just come up with some ideas or things that you might think are interesting or funny or, you know, whatever angle you want to put on things. You definitely don't have to record a promo and send it to me. But if you do want to do that, I don't want to stifle your creativity. So please feel free to record a promo if you choose and then send it to me. I would ask that you send it as an MP3 or WAV file. That way I can play around with it and do, you know, whatever's necessary. Now, one person is going to win this contest, and you will win something awesome, which I can't tell you what it is yet, but then you're also going to get full credit for the promo. The credit will be posted on the blog and also be inserted into the credits of each and every show. So that way your name's going to be out there with everyone who listens to the show. So I'm hoping that you'll take the time to participate in this contest and submit your promo idea. Remember, you want to send it to cwfgamecast@wargamingforums.com. You have until midnight Eastern Standard Time on Friday, March 30th to get your submission to me. So you have some time. I hope you participate, and I look forward to seeing all the great ideas that all of you come up with for a promo for the show. Now, the bulk of the show is actually going to go ahead and talk about the imagination, or, you know, make-believe worlds, as it was. Before we get into that, I do want to briefly kind of do an update on some books. Previously, I've talked about a set. It's a Jack Steele set of books. And I had mentioned that I read the first one, which was Man of Honor. I had said that it kind of reminded me a little bit about some of the Sharp novels and some of the other books by Bernard Cornwell. The Jack Steele series takes place during the Wars of the Spanish Succession. And they kind of focus on a Captain Jack Steele who is in Marlborough's army, and, you know, it deals with the battles of Blenheim and going into the Dutch Netherlands and dealing with the Battle of Ramillies and like all sorts of stuff. Now, Rules of War is the second novel, and I don't want to give away too much, but some things that happen at the end of Man of Honor you would think would continue on into Rules of War. They don't. I also kind of thought that the writing in Rules of War did not live up to the levels that existed in Man of Honor. Now, you might recall that I did say that Man of Honor was, you know, an enjoyable read and was interesting, but that it wasn't as good as things that Bernard Cornwell has written. It wasn't there, but it was interesting. And I enjoyed reading it, and I knew I wanted to continue reading the Jack Steele series. As far as I know, there's three in the series, I believe. So I did want to continue, and, you know, the War of the Spanish Succession was an area that I had limited knowledge about, so I felt that it would not only be interesting to read these, but that it would give me maybe a little bit of a push to learn a little bit more about the War of the Spanish Succession, you know, get this viewpoint on it from a historical novel, and maybe read some nonfiction about it as well. This particular novel, Rules of War, like I said, is the second one, and it deals with an interesting siege for the armies involved. I don't want to reveal too much about what happens with it, but let's just say it involves a girl, it involves pirates, and who doesn't love pirates, and it involves the French. It's very cool. It has some nice pacing, some good action. I felt like I could visualize what was happening in the book. Unfortunately, like I said, I felt the writing wasn't that strong. If I hadn't already picked up the first one, if I didn't have this inclination to read these already, I probably would not have. I was kind of disappointed with the second novel. I'm waiting to read the third one. I hope the third one is better. And I was also kind of surprised that at the end of the second novel, I believe it was in, you know, the notes at the end, like the historical notes, that a word was misspelled. And it's a pretty common word and one used throughout the novel. And I can't fathom how it was missed in the editing process. But the word was English, as in the English who live in England. For whatever reason, it was misspelled, it wasn't caught in editing, and that kind of lowered my expectations of what's going to happen in the third novel, and it also kind of lowered my opinion of those involved with putting these books out. I know the author is a journalist who's written other novels, historical novels, and I think I might want to try them. I'm not 100% positive. We're going to have to see what happens in the third novel. But the second one here, you see a lot of action, you see some good character development, you see some changes in composition of the forces, and it was just kind of cool to see some of the stuff that happened in the War of the Spanish Succession, and be able to feel some of the political intrigue involved. If this is something that you might be interested in, I would recommend picking it up, and just giving it a try and seeing what you think. I'm going to get it from the library, which is how I would recommend that you get all of your novels and all of your books. It's a good way to sample stuff, and that way you can put your money towards, you know, rule books and magazine subscriptions, models, and all that sort of stuff. So, Rules of War by Ian Gill. It's the second novel in the Jack Steele series, put out by HarperCollins in the UK. Came out in 2008. It's a hardcover with 336 pages. So it's something that you might want to consider. Also, I want to fast forward a few hundred years, at least. And I want to talk again about some World War II books. I've mentioned how I'm able to get some really cool World War II books that are primary documents dealing with Hitler. So I'm just pulling one out right now, and this is actually one that deals with Mussolini, and it's about Mussolini's trip to Germany. Now, these have fantastic pictures. There's all sorts of photographs in here, and you might be thinking, why would anyone really want to look at a book full of propaganda pictures that are basically saying, oh, the Nazis are great, the Nazis are good, yay fascism, and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, normally I would agree with you, but these images reveal quite a bit into the mindset of propaganda people. It reveals quite a bit into the mindset of the Nazi Party, and it also shows a lot of the equipment, the vehicles, the weaponry, the uniforms used by these entities. So if you are, say you're playing a World War II game, maybe it's Flames of War, maybe something else, and you want to know exactly what they had. One of these books would be fantastic because you can look, you can see all the troops, and you can say, oh, you know, at such and such a time, they wore this, and then at a different time, they wore that. Now, this one obviously is geared to show the solidarity between Italy and Germany, which is interesting because anyone with even a basic understanding of World War II and the roles of the Axis powers knows that Hitler was not such a fan of Mussolini and thought that he was kind of a waste of space. And Mussolini didn't do much of anything, which is good. I mean, you don't want the forces of evil to do well. But it was just kind of interesting that, you know, they went through all this trouble and spent all this money to put out this official book. And, like, Hitler hated the guy. So it was just kind of cool to see the images and see all that. There are two other books that I have. One's Hitler in Italy, which is also cool because it's basically the reverse. The pictures are by the same guy, Hitler's personal photographer, Heinrich Hoffmann. But this time, the focus is all on the Italian military, the Italian countryside, the Italian people. So you're able to see the uniforms of the Italian army. You're able to see vessels from the Italian Navy and so forth. And it's really cool to be able to see some amazing landmarks, and you can look and just see what's going on with the ships and everything. And then I have another one where Hitler goes into the Sudetenland, obviously earlier in World War II, but you can just see the propaganda and how they were able to use it to portray Hitler as, you know, this wonderful leader who is rescuing the people. And I mean, it's just also absurd and bullcrap, really, but they're just fascinating documents to look at. I've mentioned them before, books like these before. If you're able to get a chance to look at anything like this, I would recommend it, if for no other reason than just to kind of see a piece of history, really. I mean, the primary documents published by the Third Reich during World War II, so there has to be something pretty cool about that. Again, you'd have to go to your local library and take a peek and see if they have them. And if they don't, and they probably don't. But if they don't, see if they can get them from another library for you. That's what I did, and it worked for me. And I got to say, they're very interesting documents, especially for anyone with an interest in World War II history. So now, at this point, I've kind of bustled along and covered the promo contest and the little blurb about those books. I want to focus mainly on the imaginations. Now, this is a way for wargamers to create their own historical context, so to speak. You can build your own nation, you can create and design your own armed forces and the uniform colors and the organization, and then you can play a campaign against friends, against yourself. Maybe you're going to do some solo war gaming. You can build a map, and like, you basically are creating the world from the ground up. Now, the inspiration for all of this came from Henry Hyde. Henry, long time ago, Henry created the Wars of the Faltenian Succession. Now, he talks about this in Battalions Magazine, and I believe it was issues 1 through 5, maybe, that deal in particular with the creating of a world. Now, I've wanted to make my own make-believe nation for a war game for quite a while, but I didn't have the abilities. One of the things that kind of held me up, well, two things that held me up the most was the time that would be involved with it, and then creating a map. Believe it or not, doing anything graphically like that with, you know, visuals and creating like images and that sort of stuff, it's just not my forte. I'm not very good at it. I struggle, and I have a really hard time. So I've been on the lookout for quite a while, for maybe a decade or longer, for a program that would allow me to do a few things where I could create a map for, you know, campaign or just about anything, any type of game like that. I recently came across one called Hexographer. Now, this is a program put out by Inkwell Ideas, and it has a free version and a paid version. As you might guess, it allows you to create hex-based maps. And it has a myriad of terrain types, so you can have, you know, hills and wooded hills and wooded mountains, snow-capped mountains, plains and farmland and rivers and oceans and like all that sort of stuff. Some of the strengths of this program are not only does it have all those different terrain types and allow you to place down like cities and rivers and towns and roads and so forth, but it works on Mac OS X, which I use. It also works on Windows. It's a cross-platform piece of software. It's intuitive in that it's very easy for a noob like myself to use. I can export the maps into a common image for format. I believe it's PNG for this. So then I can take those images. I can either print them out. I can email them, put them on the blog, put them on Facebook, link to them on Twitter or whatever. And then it's also affordable. Now, I had mentioned that there's a free version, rather. And the free version kind of covers many things. There are some features that it does not have. But that's okay, because you can, you know, use it online and get a feel for it. You can make some maps. You can save the maps onto your computer. You can print them out. You can, you know, save versions of the maps. You can save them in the format that you can use to edit them in the program. So it's really cool that you can do all that. It's a very strong try before you buy setup, which I like a lot. Now, it also has a paid version, or they called it a pro version, basically. And it is not cheap as far as, you know, this type of program goes. And as soon as I had used the program, I knew that I wanted to buy it. But I kind of hesitated because it cost $25, $24.95 for the program. And the pro version, the full version of it, it allows you to import other icon types. There are some custom icons that are on their website that you can get for free, or you can make them yourself. You can buy another set of icons that cost $20. The pro version also allows you to resize the map. So let's say you're working on the map and you realize that you need to make it bigger. Well, with the free version, you would have to start from scratch with a new map if you wanted to make it bigger. But with the pro version, you can just go ahead and then you can expand it. You can say, I need to add 20 rows to the right, 10 to the bottom, 5 to the left, or whatever. Or maybe it turns out you need to make it smaller. You can do that as well, and you don't have to start over with a fresh map or anything. Now, the program is really cool because it works very well for wargamers. It has all the different terrain types that just make sense, whether you want to do medieval or modern or American War of Independence like I am, Napoleonics, or whatever. You can do all of that. It also has a whole set of icons and everything for sci-fi, so you can do space. Maybe you're going to do a Firefly-based campaign, or you need a map for, you know, a Star Wars, whatever that you did, or, you know, whatever, like Battlestar Galactica. You can definitely do that. It has black and white hexes as well, so that way you can print out, and you don't need to worry as much about the ink you're using, because maybe you don't want to be spending all that money on color ink to do a fancy color one. Maybe you just need black and white to mark up or whatever. You can do that. It's really easy. They also have the ability where you can just insert, you know, buildings. So maybe you're going to draw out a town or a city or something like that. And you can just easily do that as well. Now, in addition to all of this, you can set elevations for the square, the hexes. I was going to say squares for the hexes. You can choose for a forest, say, to cover only part of a hex. Maybe you don't want it to be a whole hex. Maybe you want it to be a fourth of a hex, or, you know, whatever. You can choose that. You can also draw an outline that represents the national boundaries. You can draw rivers and streams and oceans. There are tiles that represent different depths of ocean. So you might have like a sea, maybe a deep ocean, a normal ocean, or whatever. So that allows you to visually see the changes. It's really cool. You can put roads and, I mean, there's just all sorts of icons and different hex types in there. It's fascinating what they've done. Now, the big thing with the pro version, and the reason why I really wanted to make sure I got it, but the big thing with it is that when you buy the pro version, it includes support for the life of the project, and it also includes free updates whenever they come out with an update for this particular full version. So if they find a bug and they release a bug fix or whatever, you're covered. You don't have to worry about like being like, oh, I need to go and get something different and do this and that or whatever. Now, the other reason why I really wanted to make sure that I got this is because I wanted to support the company that does this. And it's a small company. It's a one-man show, I think. I had emailed the guy who was the one-man company, basically, because I couldn't tell by looking on the website if it worked, if the program worked with Mac, if it worked just with Windows, or what it was. Like, I couldn't find any sort of system requirements, which was a little disappointing. So I emailed them to find out, you know, does it work with Mac? Does it work with OS X? I'm on Lion. Is it going to work with that? Because some older programs are, you know, PowerPC programs, and they don't work on Lion anymore. And I got a reply almost instantaneously telling me, oh, yeah, you know, I coded this 80% on a Mac. It works on a Mac. I'm trying it out on Lion right now. I'll let you know. And next thing, the next morning, I got another email from him saying, you know, everything's fine on Lion. If you want to buy it, go ahead and buy it. And, you know, you can just get the program, whatever. So I have the program, and it's amazing. I really, really love the program. I can't say enough great things about it. One of the reasons why I can't say enough great things about it is because that my imagination project would not exist without this program. Because it is so easy to create maps, update them, edit them, export them, etc. Because it's so easy to do all that and to create them where they look so good, I was able to just progress. Because normally I'd be like, okay, you know, let me make a map. Because I want to have this campaign, I want to make a map and do it, and then I would stop because I couldn't make the map. It would just be my stumbling block. I tried things like Photoshop, which I'm not good with, and, you know, just GIMP and all sorts of other stuff. And, like, I couldn't do them. They was beyond me. But Hexographer works. It's just, it's fantastic, and it made everything possible. So you might be thinking, wow, he's just talking a lot about Hexographer and how great it is. Are they paying him to do this? Like, why is he just gushing about them? And the reason why I'm gushing is that without this program, my imagination campaign just wouldn't happen. So let's talk a little bit more about my campaign. I had said that I was inspired by Henry Hyde's own, you know, he has the Nations of Prunkland, which is one of my favorites, actually, and Faultonland. And he's had them going at it for longer than I've been alive, I think. And, you know, they battle and everything. And I mean, it's just, it's really cool reading about it. And he has it on his blog and everything. And more you see other gamers doing the same thing. A lot of them just kind of talk about it. And, you know, they might do their role-playing aspect, which is very interesting for me. But they might not do so much on the tabletop. And I thought, well, I think I want to try this. I wanted to try it for a long time. I do the map. So why not get started and see where I go? I had a feeling that I wanted to set mine based on the American Revolution, the War of American Independence. But I didn't really have a decision made on where to go with it until the map was made. I just kind of went at it and built the map. Now, Henry has articles, and I gotta recommend that you go to the Battle Games website. They're owned by Atlantic Publishers now, but you go to the Battle Games magazine website and get it. Just buy the magazine. And if you can get issues 1 through 5, I think it is what, I think those are the ones that cover, you know, how to build a world and everything. That's the crux of the matter, because it outlines how to do it. And Henry has a fantastic setup for how you can go ahead and create your world. And I followed what he did. You decide on the size of map you want, and for each hex, you roll a die, and that basically tells you terrain type. Is it going to be flat? Is it going to be hilly? And then you roll another d6. And based on that, you learn, is it going to be wooded? Is it going to be mountainous? Or, like, whatever. And you do that for each and every single hex. And then you go back, because you need to populate the world, and how many cities are there, and where are they, and you, how many rivers, and, you know, cities are going to be near the rivers, and you determine all of that, and then you determine the income based on the terrain types you have, based on the population, and all of that sort of stuff. And it's a step-by-step process. It can take a little while, but not terribly long. When I first did it, I had a smaller map than what I have now, and I only had a few nations. I started off with what is now Glauland and part of Natickingham and part of New Deadhampton, but I did not have everything that's on the map there. And at first I thought, oh, you know, they're just going to fight each other across the borders, and, you know, we'll come up with a story and see how it goes. But then the more I thought about it, the more I realized how much I really wanted to do something like the American Revolution. So that meant that I expanded the map further to the east and further to the south. So I gave more land to the what are going to be the colonies. And I built an ocean, the Bradford Ocean, that connects to the Ayer Bay. And across the other side of the Bradford Ocean is Deadhampton, which, of course, as you might guess, is based on the United Kingdom. And I've had to populate that with train types and people and rivers and everything and come up with income for all of that. All told, over the weekend, I spent maybe 12 or 14 hours, not in a row, but, you know, good chunks of time together, creating the map, populating it, coming up with names, building roads, and all that sort of stuff. And I had a blast. I loved it so much, I didn't want to go to bed at night. I just wanted to stay up. And when I was in bed, I was dreaming about this. I was thinking, what am I going to do? And, oh, maybe there so-and-so is going to get into context for war, and, oh, I should name this city that, and what are the people going to be like, and this and that, and what rules am I going to do? It's just like one thing after another. I was smitten is really what it was. I just adored this, and I could not get enough of it. And then I'd wake up the next morning, and the first thing I'd want to do would be sit down at the computer, work up some more on the map, work some more on my spreadsheets, and everything. Just go right at it, and I loved it all. And I still do. I've got to say, you know, I'm at work. I go to work, and I'm working. I'm thinking, I can't wait till I get home so I can work on my project because this is so cool. Last night, I stayed up really late doing a really long write-up about my project and just kind of explaining some of the stuff that I've done and everything. And I mean, I just loved it. I was up really late. But this is so exciting for me. After I first decided to do this and after I finished the map, I sent Henry an email. And I was like, Henry, do you know what? It's all your fault because you got me really interested in doing this. And I'm loving every second of it. But you had to blame because you inspired me to do this. And then he went on the blog and he posted a comment, and I really enjoyed reading his comment, which I'm actually going to read right now. He says, "Well done, Jonathan. You finally succumbed to the imagination's bug. It's one of the most absorbing aspects of the hobby you'll ever embark on, and your games will be so much more meaningful now that you have all the background material you have generated. Welcome aboard." And he's added, "And Hexographer looks very interesting too. I'll give it a go myself." So it meant a lot for me, first, that Henry was able to take the time to post a comment and to read my email, because I know he's finishing up his book and getting that out. He has so many projects that he works on. So Henry, I really appreciated you taking the time to post a comment and get back to me. But also, it helped to spur me on to be like, you know what? I'm going the right way. I got the bug. I'm eager to do this and just kind of keep on going. At that point, I then had realized that this was, like I said, going to be an American Revolution kind of based setup with my own areas. So I decided that Deadhampton is based on the United Kingdom, and it's the only nation in my campaign right now. All the other entities are colonies of Deadhampton. So we have New Deadhampton. I'm sure you can guess where the name came from. Natickingham, which is a moderate-sized colony that has limited coastal access, unlike New Deadhampton, which is a small colony but tons of coast. And Glauland is a large colony bordering the wilderness. Who only knows what's on the other side of the wilderness? Probably some sort of my version of American Indians. And then I named my whole project the Deadhampton Revolution. So the map I created is pretty big. It's something like 50 to 60 hexes across, maybe 20 hexes top to bottom. So it's a wide map, not so much a square. It's definitely a rectangle. And there's tons of water on there. So as you can guess, it's going to be lots of naval fighting, most likely. And one of the reasons why I made the map so big was I do love naval fighting, and I do want to try the Trafalgar rule set. But I wanted to make sure that I tried to emulate some of the distance involved in moving men, material, and supplies from the homeland to the colonies and vice versa. Now, at the start of my campaign, the colonies are not at war with their motherland. They're just not. Everyone's, you know, contentious. Deadhampton has a limited amount of land, and they need more revenues and more money, even though they're the wealthiest. But they fought lots of battles with neighboring nations, and they just need to replenish everything. So the colonies dislike that they have to pay higher taxes and stuff. But at the same time, you have some conflict within the colonies, because Glauland, for example, is the largest and wealthiest colony. But it's on the border of the wilderness, so it has to deal with all the problems that entails. It happens to have the most number of mines that gives them all sorts of valuables, lots of mineral wealth, but it makes up for that by having lots of wooded area and lots of hills. And like I said, it's on the borderline with the wilderness. And I can't emphasize that enough, because bad things can and most likely will come out of the wilderness to go into Glauland. Then you got Natikinkam, which is, like I said, a moderate size, but it doesn't have a whole lot of mineral wealth. It only has two mines, and its space is a mix between wooded, mountainous, and hilly areas, and open plains that are not farmland. It has very little farmland, so that's going to cause problems for, you know, raising troops and feeding them and everything. And it does have some coastal access, but not much, and it's actually severely limited because New Deadhampton, with its extensive coastal properties and coastline, blocks off access into Natikinkam. Now, New Deadhampton has very limited mineral wealth, which, of course, is a cause of contention. It needs that, but it also needs more living space. It's very tied. Most of its area is basically air bay that it controls. It does not have as much land. Now, Deadhampton, like I mentioned, has need of more supplies, materials, and resources. It has no mines, no mineral wealth whatsoever. That's a problem. It has to import a lot of things. It has a small outpost on the colonies, in addition to the colonies, but this is directly under the Crown's control. So it's right there, but it also controls all of the oceans. So as you can see, there's the chance for this powder keg to go off, whether there are going to be conflicts between the colonies or with the motherland or, you know, with the wilderness or nations that aren't on the map yet. I wrote a lengthy blog post about all of this, and I was just kind of telling people what I had done. And someone, Court, actually left a comment about all of this, because in my blog post, I had mentioned that right now it's just me doing this. I'm solo gaming it as soon as I start, and that, you know, people are welcome to take my ideas and to take Henry's ideas and use them as inspiration for their own campaign or to join into mine, and that I'm happy to. Of course, you know, I'm not going to be able to do tons of people with the campaign because I'm just starting out, and that would just take so much work. But Court asked if the technology in my campaign would be 18th century based, meaning 1700s, like American Revolution. And he also asked how I was going to handle other major powers or if I would be excluding them. So I had remarked that, you know, this is actually a really good idea and great questions for me to consider. So after mulling it over, I did decide that, yeah, the technology would be from the 1700s, but I did not want to restrict technology because, you know, this is a imagination campaign. It's a make-believe world. And although it's based on the American Revolution and the technology around that time, that, I mean, there's no reason why my imagination can't wander into other nearby areas and take, you know, bits of inspiration and technology from those areas and put them into here. So maybe, you know, I might play with dates a little bit or create my own things or whatever. Now, regarding major powers, right now I'm the only one controlling all of this, and I can't see adding other major powers for me to control. If anything, if people join in, and like I said, I'd love to have you, I would love for them to take over, you know, one of the colonies or the Motherland or whatever, you know, to take one of these. But there would definitely be just cause for the interaction with other nations. So, you know, my version of France, whatever that might happen to be, maybe they're going to help the colonies, but, you know, maybe this time they might send an expeditionary force to be involved or whatever. Like, might not actually need to map out that nation and assign full troops and everything like that to it just yet. I might be able to do kind of like random encounters, so to speak, where they just kind of get minorly involved with the campaign and see how it goes. So that is a possibility. Now, I've kind of talked a lot about, you know, the map and all that sort of stuff, so I want to move on, because I haven't talked at all about population, money, or, you know, men at arms or any of that kind of stuff. And, I mean, a war game needs men, needs money to, you know, pay the troops and feed them and stuff, and you need people to actually be the troops. So when I was doing all this sort of stuff, it involves math, and I'm not a math person, but, you know, sometimes you just gotta do it. So I set up a spreadsheet, and my favorite spreadsheet program, and I just kind of plugged in the information. I went, again, by Henry Hyde's suggestions on how you determine how many people there are and how you determine the population, and all that's kind of just based on the hex type. So as you can tell, it's really important when you roll up your hexes to record what you had, what types they are, and make sure you keep track of that. So I had gone ahead and I did all that, and after, you know, adding up the mine income, the income from the hex types and taxes and everything, I came up with some values, and no surprise, Dead Hampton, you know, the homeland, is the richest power player in this. Glauland, the largest colony, is the second, and New Dead Hampton's last. Now, you might be thinking, well, how did he come up with some of these variables? So most of them was things that were devised by Henry Hyde. But when it came to population, I had to think a little bit. I did some research online, which is very important, and there's a book. It's Population of the United States Before the 1790 Census, or before the Census of 1790, something like that. And I, you know, looked around, and some of that information was available online, but when I looked around, I realized that a local library actually had it, so I was able to go and look at it, and it details, you know, what towns and counties had for populations and stuff, and that allowed me to figure out how many people I could tax, the average tax rate, and, you know, how many households there were, because at that point, taxes were done by household and not by person, and just like all that sort of stuff. So then I was able to extrapolate that information and go ahead and figure out how many males and females. And like Henry, I just broke it down in half. I said 50% men, 50% women. It's not accurate, I know, but it just made the bookkeeping so much easier. And then using all of this information, I figured out that I needed to come up with information that would tell me how many infantry regiments I could have, how many cavalry regiments, how many artillery regiments. So I did some more research, and it turns out there's a book about the American Revolutionary War, which is all online on the Army's website, and there's charts in there, which I had made copies of. I based all of my information for basically 1776, 1777. Again, you could use whatever you wanted, but I was able to find out the disposition, well, the ideal disposition of an infantry regiment from 1776, or a light dragoon regiment in 77, an artillery regiment in 76, a South Carolina artillery regiment in 75, a partisan corps in 1781. And then I was able to take all of that, and I, you know, added all the numbers up, and I found out, for example, that in 1776, a Continental Army Infantry Regiment was supposed to have 541 men. You know, the cavalry was supposed to have 280, artillery 305, and so forth and so forth. So then I was able to take all those numbers and do some calculations, and I realized that I was able to come up with, for a new Dead Hampton, because I haven't done all the nations yet, and I use that term loosely, because you know, most are not nations, they're actually colonies, but for the other nations. And so I haven't done them yet. But for New Deadhampton, I realized that I could have a maximum of 17 infantry regiments, and that's a lot of infantry. And I actually kind of played with the figures a little bit, because there's a certain number of fighting men that I have. New Deadhampton has almost 10,500 people who can be in the military. And I, you know, had to divide it out for, you know, how many men are in the infantry regiment and how many infantry regiments I can have and so forth. But basically, you have your pie is 100%. And out of that pie, you need to take chunks out for infantry, for cavalry, artillery, and so forth. So I decided that New Deadhampton has 90% of their armed forces as infantry. Infantry would be the most common. They're the cheapest. You do them and it's easy. I decided that 5% would be cavalry. I decided that 5% would be artillery. But then I broke things down a little bit more. And I decided that all of the total infantry regiments that I have, well, the people on foot, that, you know, New Deadhampton's not going to have a trained army. It wouldn't have that. I mean, these people, they're farmers, they're, you know, fishermen, that sort of stuff. So most of them would be militia regiments. I decided that 60% of the foot fighting force would be militia. So that means 10 regiments would be militia and 7 would be proper, like, continental infantry. After I did all of this, I realized I left out something very important. The Navy. And you would think that I would have realized that after I had New Deadhampton with all that coastal areas and all of the ocean right next to them. But it didn't come to me until I did all the calculations and I was getting ready for bed. And then I thought, well, let me look and see how many people it would take to crew a ship. So the first ship that came to mind, partly because I love it, and yes, I know it didn't actually exist at this time period, but again, creative license. When in doubt, creative license, was the USS Constitution. So I went ahead and I looked up the USS Constitution on Wikipedia. I know Wikipedia, not exactly peer-reviewed, not exactly very scholarly, but, you know, decent enough for my purposes. And I was able to tell that the USS Constitution had a complement that was a decent number of people, that it cost over $302,000 at the time to build it. And based on that information, I realized, wait a sec, I should, you know, maybe kind of think about redoing the numbers so I can actually have a Navy, because that would be, you know, pretty cool and it would be important, especially since, I don't know, any fighting is likely to happen on sea, on the, you know, on the pond, as it were, with all of the wide open spaces. So I thought, okay, I'm going to have to work on that. And I haven't done that yet, but I did decide, well, I definitely got to do that. I'm using the Constitution as an example, but I've actually gone ahead and I've taken stats that I found, again, on Wikipedia for all of those, quote-unquote, 44-gun frigates, and I know they weren't all 44 guns, I understand that, but I took all that, and I'm going to look at that, come up with an average. A lot of them were actually only 38 guns, but I have, you know, the USS the United States, I have the USS President, the Congress, the Constellation, the Chesapeake, you know, the original six, I think they're called. And I'm just going to kind of look at them. And they all have varying, you know, costs to build and complements and everything. So, like, the Constitution, $302,000. And then you go down, and I'm just taking a quick glance because I have everything in front of me. And actually, the Constellation, I'm sorry, was $314,000. But you go down to the Congress, which is $197,000. And the reason why I'm pointing all this out is because in a campaign, you don't just start with all your forces. You need to raise your units. So the fact that I can have 10 militia regiments doesn't mean I actually have those. That's my maximum. That's if I want to take every single person I can who can fight, disrupt their lives, disrupt the economy, I can have that. But I also have to have the money to equip, to feed, you know, etc. I need to have the money to build a ship, to equip it, to get the men for it, and all that sort of stuff. I need to have the men to go on the ship. So it's important to know how much money you have coming in and how much it's going to cost to do some of the stuff. Like, is it going to cost $5,000, so to speak, to buy guns and equipment for an infantry regiment? Maybe not. I don't know. But you need to know that, so you, that way you can't be like, oh, I'm raising 4 new infantry regiments when you really only have the money for 2. So I'm going to be looking at all this and kind of coming up with an average, because when I just looked at the Constitution at first and I looked at the incomes of my made-up nations, you see, the most expensive, or the wealthiest one rather, is Dead Hampton, and it only has $287,000 roughly per year. There's no way it could build just one of these ships. So I'm going to need to come up with an average, or I'm going to have to maybe play with things a little bit. Maybe I'm going to have to decrease the cost of the ships, or, you know, something. I don't know. But I'm going to have to think about it. And this is the sort of stuff that you two, if you do a campaign like this, are going to have to consider. Now, what's really cool is that in my part of the world, here in New England, we have lots of information about all of this. Because, I mean, a lot of it happened up here. A lot of it was inspired by up here. And, I mean, the information is just here. We have fantastic libraries and access to information. It's just, it's wonderful to be able to get into all of this. So these are different things that I'm going to have to look at and evaluate. Now, one of the other things that you're going to have to consider, in addition to the population and this and that, is you are going to have some bookkeeping if you do your own imagination. I have Microsoft Excel. I got, you know, different sheets in my workbook. So I have like a sheet on just the population of all the countries in my campaign in the Dead Hampton Revolution. So I got, you know, Glaulin and Tickingham and so forth and so forth, and how many cities they got and this and that, how many people, and I just got the breakdown for everything. You're going to need to know the income you have for the mines, what type of mines, this and that, income you have because of, you know, cultivated hexes and riverbanks and oceans and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One thing I kind of alluded to earlier, but I didn't come out and say, was the tax rate. I just kind of, you know, used that census information to come up, and I did some number crunching to figure out the average income per hex type, the number of households, the average population per hex type, the average households per hex type. I used Henry's guideline of 5 people per household. And then just all of that, I just kind of played with, you know, average income per household and average tax per household and household tax and this and that. So that added more money and stuff. And I mean, you could really go crazy with the bookkeeping aspect alone. And if your campaign got large enough, you might need to have like a monopoly banker, so to speak, who just handles bookkeeping and says, oh, you can afford to raise this many people and that, or people, someone to handle all the dispatches for, you know, orders of, you know, reconnaissance and invasions and just like everything. And I mean, all the bookkeeping I've been doing so far doesn't even cover the stuff for actual fighting. This is just prep work, and it's a lot of fun and I love it, but I mean, it can definitely get crazy. So I'm thankful that right now I'm trying to keep things small and just kind of move on and see how things go. You might be wondering what rule systems I'm planning to use for my games. Now, any games that I play are going to be played by myself because I'm solo gaming this. But I intend to use Black Powder, and I intend to use Warhammer Historical Trafalgar for naval battles. Now, I'm hoping that some of my gaming buddies won't have a problem with me using some of our games to represent battles in my campaign. So let's say that my gaming buddies and I are playing a Black Powder game. We do an American War of Independence. And, you know, I'm using my Americans, which might represent, you know, one of my colonists or whatever. And that however the game goes will be representative of what happens in my campaign. Now, I'm not saying that my gaming buddy is going to actually use, you know, British troops or whatever. But, you know, whatever they have, I will just have that be representative of things. Now, if any of my gaming buddies actually want to play in the campaign, all the better. And then, you know, we'll actually be playing the real stuff and going through things. And I mean, that'd be awesome. But if not, you know, I'll use the Black Powder games that we play as that. Or if I have to, I mean, this is no problem. I can just use, you know, pen, paper, tokens, etc. when I'm at home and just kind of do things on my own here. It's simple enough to do. Now, Trafalgar is a little more difficult because I don't actually own the rulebook. A friend of mine does, but I bet I can persuade him to break that out and break out his ships so we can play some Aegis Seal naval fighting. And that, again, I can just use that to stand in for any naval battles that I actually have. So there are ways around it. Of course, it's better if people are actually playing in this with you. Henry had his friend Guy, and they played for a long time and everything. But I think Henry still kind of solo games his Wars of Faultenian Succession. And maybe I'm wrong. I think so. So, like I said, you know, I'm going to do this basically solo. And that's fine. I'm going to give it a try and see what we do. I'm still getting the background done. But I'm hopeful to start this soon. I assure you that I'm going to give you updates on all of this. If you're really interested in learning more about this, I know I've kind of talked your ears off about it. I've been going on for quite a while on this one topic. But if you're really interested, I'm going to be doing more writing on the blog about this. And that's probably going to be the primary location that you will find information about the Deadhampton Revolution. I'm going to have a tag, the Deadhampton Revolution. That's going to have everything in it. But of course, I'll tag, you know, the post as appropriate. So if I'm dealing with Black Powder, they'll have a Black Powder tag, or Trafalgar. They're all going to have historical gaming, even though I know it's not real historicals. I'm not recreating the actual American Revolution. I'm doing my own take on it, but they're going to have, you know, historical gaming tags and AWI, American Rev, and so forth. That just makes it easier for all of you, I think, to find the associated posts or things that are similar. And I have a cool thing on the blog where at the bottom of every article that I write, every posting, it lists five other articles / posts that it thinks is similar to the one you're reading. So that way you can then just go ahead and click around and find other stuff. So for example, I'm looking at the posting I put up titled Deadhampton Revolution Revealed. It's a really long post. It's like 1,200 words or something like that. That I just kind of talked about a lot of things I've talked about here in the podcast, but other things, and I go in a little more details, and there are links and stuff in that one. But at the bottom of that, it mentions that you might want to read the Deadhampton Revolution, where I first talk about the details with the Deadhampton Revolution, wargaming map making. It's another one where I talk about Hexographer in my starting with the whole imagination thing, Saturday Historical Gaming. Then there's episode 62 of the podcast, which is the Battle of Abington. It's a Black Powder game that I actually played. And then a first glance at Battle Hymns magazine number 26. So it just kind of gives you, you know, related things. But like I said, I would strongly recommend that you go to the blog, wargamingforums.com, and look up Deadhampton Revolution. I'm going to try to have that somewhere in the title, but if it doesn't fit, you're sure to find it somewhere in the actual posting. Or if all else fails, just use the Deadhampton Revolution tag on the blog, and you'll find all the associated stuff. So it should be really cool. Like I said, I'll let you know how I come along with it. There's still more work to go, but I'm very excited about it. I'm eager to get on with it, to get stuck in, and see what happens. I'm still going to be playing all, you know, the other games that I've been playing, board games, and just other Black Powder games. You know, we've been doing a lot of Civil War and stuff. And actually, talking about Civil War, I do just want to mention something briefly. I know I've been talking at length. My voice is probably a little scratchy, for which I do apologize. But I do just want to quickly talk about one other thing before we end, because this is almost an hour, and I like to keep episodes for about an hour. It makes it a little easier for me to edit, and that way you don't have to dedicate too much of your time to listening to me. In a recent issue of War Games Illustrated, I think it was maybe... I think it was maybe the February issue for 2012. They talk about a one-day campaign. Now, a one-day campaign sounds really cool. It sounds like an easy way to do, you know, a historical campaign or an imagined one like I'm doing, but just a little simpler. And they do it basically for Vikings and, you know, that sort of stuff. But I took that and I used the Hexographer, and this is actually... when I first tried out Hexographer, I tried it out with the free version. But I made a map. I did not use Henry's guidelines. I just kind of made a map on my own. I got to tell you, it's nowhere near as cool as the one I made using Henry's guidelines. But I made a map, and I set it in the American Civil War. It's inspired by the American Civil War. to run my own one-day campaign. Now, I kind of use the scenario, so to speak, in Wargames Illustrated as a guide for what to do. But I'm going to run this for two of my gaming buddies, or however many want to show up. And I'm going to see how it goes. It's supposed to take 4 to 6 hours. I have a map. It, you know, shows Union lines, and it shows things owned by the Confederacy and stuff. And there's going to be objectives that have to happen. Now, one of the ways that you can make a one-day campaign work is that for one or more sides, you basically determine in advance what's going to happen. Now, you can do that for one side, and then you allow the players from the other side to create their own orders, so to speak, of, you know, we're going to do this, then we're going to do that, this, that, and so forth. And they have to adhere to that and just follow it. So basically, you're just kind of doing like an order of operations. You're saying, like, you know, it'd be like when you wake up in the morning and you're going to decide what you're going to do the moment you wake up till the moment you reach your goal of going out the door to go to work. And so you're going to say, like, the first thing you get up, or then you're going to brush your teeth or go to the bathroom or whatever. And, like, you can't change that. So, like, the first thing you got to do is get up. The second thing you got to do is go to the bathroom, like, so forth. But, of course, any good general is going to add in contingencies. So you're going to put in, well, you're going to get up, and then you're going to go to the bathroom. But if someone else is in there, instead you're going to go and pick out your clothes for the morning. Or, like, you know, whatever. So you're going to try to cover all eventualities. And both sides are going to have to follow the orders as they are. If members of opposite sides happen to cross, meet up at any point as a result of the orders, there's a chance for combat, and then the combat gets played out. We're going to play this with black powder. We're using 15mm American Civil War models that Court has. He has fantastic terrain and all sorts of stuff. So I devised a scenario. I gave orders to one of the sides. We'll see how well I did. And we're just going to try to see how a one-day campaign works. Hopefully everything goes well. If they like it, I might run another one. Or, you know, well, I'm hoping to run another one. But we'll see what happens. I'm hoping more people decide to play. But it'll just be a cool way to give Black Powder another twist instead of just being like, let's just make a scenario and do it. Now, this will allow us to have maybe smaller battles that should end more quickly, but to have more of them so that we can get together, say, like, on a Saturday, meet at 1, play till 6 or 7, and get, like, 4 or 5 games of Black Powder in. So it'd be really cool and allow us to try out different things and just see how it goes. The article in War Games Illustrated was fascinating to read. It really inspired me to do that, and I thought American Civil War would be a good fit, partly because we ran an American Civil War game at TotalCon. Daybreak at Hangman's Creek was the scenario, and people loved it. Now, this scenario involves the famous March to the Sea. So my one-day campaign kind of takes place as the Union is prepping for all of that before they march on Atlanta and everything. So that's kind of the stage set. Like I said, that's going to be getting played soon with my gaming buddies, and I'm going to let all of you know how that came out. It was my first chance using Hexographer and creating some maps with it, and, you know, they're not great, but all things considered, I think they came out pretty well. I mean, it was my first time playing with the maps and stuff, and I'm really excited about doing the campaign. It's my first time running a campaign, even though it's a one-day campaign, and we'll just see how it goes. Well, I want to thank all of you for listening. I know I talked a lot about make-believe stuff. You might think that make-believe is something you do when you're a little kid and you watch a Mr. Rogers. You know, I don't even know if Mr. Rogers is on TV anymore, but I love Mr. Rogers. And so hopefully you watched him as a kid, or maybe your kids did, or, you know, family members, whoever. But you might think that, you know, make-believe just happens when you go to the neighborhood of make-believe and you deal with King Friday and, you know, Trolley and all that sort of stuff. But that's not entirely true. And I know some people look down, some wargamers look down on, you know, imaginations. But really, when you think about it, to some degree, all wargaming, all gaming we do, involves your imagination. And it's just the degree to which you do it. Now, I would argue that someone like Henry Hyde, who has put so much detail into his imagined nations of Faultenland and Punkland, he's created, you know, coats of arms and uniform coloring and styles and all sorts of stuff. Some who's done all that is, you know, they put a lot of effort into it, and they're no less of a war gamer, no less of a person, no less anything than someone who's doing a strictly historical or 40K or whatever type of game. It's just another way to play, another way to have fun, and if it's your thing, and it might be, I say, you know, give it a try, and you might like it, and if it's not your thing, that's okay. You don't have to. I mean, there's different types of games, different types of ways to play the games for different types of people, and maybe sometime you might want to do an imagined gaming. Maybe other times you might just want to do strictly historical. You might just want to refight Bull Run. You might just want to refight Dunkirk or whatever. And, I mean, that's perfectly fine. All sorts of different things. But I do have to say that I haven't been this excited about gaming in a long time. So I think that Imagined Nations gaming might just be my ticket for excitement and fun and adventure. Like I said, I'll keep you appraised, and I hope you give it a try. If you are interested in playing in my campaign, and like I said, I'd be happy to have you, please email me, cwfgamecast@wargamingforums.com. Put Dead Hampton Revolution in the subject. And if you just want to, you know, give me feedback about solo games that you played, campaigns you've done, Black Powder, Imagined Nations, or whatever, I'd love to hear any and all your feedback. And lastly, don't forget, promo contest. Please submit. You have until midnight Eastern Standard Time on Friday, March 30th. I need your promo ideas, 30 seconds in length, on why the show is great, just some of the show, things that might be of interest to gamers like you. You're going to get full credit plus something awesome. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Please submit. And as always, I appreciate you taking the time to listen to the show. So thank you, and don't forget, keep on gaming.